Shocking evidence, jury drama, and witness cross-examinations. The Case of podcast takes you inside the biggest trials in the country, reporting the in-depth detail of how courts work and who's in there each week. We've brought you Erin Patterson's mushroom murder trial, the case of Toya's murder in Cairns, a Canberra cold case, the two intruders, and many more. Search for The Case Of, it's on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
The Persian Gulf is a banana-shaped waterway that connects the oil-producing nations of the Middle East to the Indian Ocean and to the wider world. At the northern tip of the Gulf are the southern ports of Iraq and Kuwait. And at the other tip, the Persian Gulf tightens into a narrow pinch point, the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz has haunted the minds of military strategists for decades because the land on one side of it belongs to Iran, which uses the strait to pressure its enemies in times of war. And that's because a quarter of all global oil production passes through it. And now, in response to heavy bombardment from the United States and Israel, Iran's effectively shut down this waterway by attacking commercial vessels that are trying to get through. And this has been described as the biggest disruption to oil supplies in the history of the world. It was feared this very scenario that had stayed the hand of previous US administrations. And at this stage, it's not clear how and when this war might end. Jennifer Parker is here today. Jennifer's actually viewed the Strait of Hormuz from the deck of an Australian warship. Jennifer served for more than 20 years as an officer with the Royal Australian Navy and was deployed to the Persian Gulf three times in her career. She's currently an associate at the ANU's National Security College and a fellow at the Lowy Institute. Hello, Jennifer.
Hey, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about your first deployment to the Persian Gulf. What was the HMAS Arunta sent there to do?
Yeah, you know, I've had to rack my brain a bit to go back to 2007. So I was 23 years old. I was off the watch, responsible for driving the ship predominantly in HMAS Arunta. We had just gone through a significant workup off the west coast of Australia where we'd been tested in our ability to do anti-submarine warfare and a whole range of things. And it had been a tedious workup because we should have taken about 4 weeks, and we made our way across the Indian Ocean, still being tested by the Navy in terms of our ability to undertake warfare operations and fight fires on the ships. And so by the time we got to the Strait of Hormuz in early December of 2007, we were a little apprehensive about what would happen next. And the reason I say apprehensive is earlier in 2007, so only about 6 months before we first sailed through the Strait of Hormuz, the boarding team from a Royal Navy ship, the HMS Cornwall, had been seized by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard right in the area that we were going to operate and detained in Tehran for 15 days. So it was quite a tense time back then as we prepared to sail through that strait, and certainly we were well aware of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and how they harassed militia ships in that area.
This is the later end of the Iraq war, isn't it, at this period? And so was there a bit of a Wild West atmosphere out there because the state had broken down? There were all sorts of actors like Al-Qaeda in Iraq that was about to develop into ISIS. Was that the kind of feeling at the time?
Look, it certainly was. So this is, yep, absolutely going back to Gulf War II. There had been a number of Al-Qaeda attacks in that region. In fact, going back to 2000, there had been a US ship that had been blown up by an Al-Qaeda small boat just off Yemen. But also, we were also very concerned about Iran and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, that might seem a little bit strange, but once we got into the Arabian Gulf, it was almost a daily effort to be harassed by Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, what we would call bog hammers at the time, which were small armed boats, and they would come and harass us, yell things at us across the radio and point their weapons at us. So it was a tense
Sorry, Jennifer. The Iranian Revolution Guard is sending small boats alongside your warship and just shouting abuse at you. Is that what they're doing?
And pointing their weapons. Now, you might think that sounds laughable, but they have quite capable weapons. And actually, when you think about the Iranian Navy, and this will come into the military objectives of the US, the Iranian Navy doesn't tend to operate in the Persian Gulf. In fact, it tends to operate outside of the strait in the Gulf of Oman. Now, it's largely been sunk by the US in the last 3 weeks. The threat inside the Gulf was actually this asymmetric capability of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy. Small boats with, you know, shoulder-launched projectiles, guns, those kind of capabilities, also explosives in the front of them, so kind of kamikaze boats. And the difference between dealing with the Iranian Navy outside of the Gulf is, yes, we had disagreements, but they were largely professional. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and if you go into their history back to the revolution, is very ideological, so very unpredictable. And so these situations could actually quickly escalate because you have limited time to determine whether it is a threat to your vessel. And if it poses a threat to your vessel, then you have to make the decision about whether you engage it or not and create a national incident. So interesting times.
So when you enter the Strait of Hormuz, that narrow pinch point I'm talking about, how wide is that actually? Can you see from shore to shore as you're passing through this pinch point?
Yeah, so you can when you get to its narrowest point, and this is one of the challenges about whether, you know, escorting or defending against Iranian attacks in the strait. It's 33 kilometres across at its narrowest point, but it's also quite navigationally constrained. So even though at its narrowest point it might be 33 kilometres across, there's not a lot of safe navigational water to move either side, maybe a couple of kilometres. So what that means, if you go outside of the safe navigational water, then you might see yourself stuck on a rock or something unpleasant. And so when you think about that, you think about how many ships are going through there, obviously not right now, but back in 2007, you know, the Strait of Hormuz would tend to have anywhere between 100, 130 ships going through that congested waterway every day. On top of those ships, a lot of fishing vessels operating there, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps operating there. It is an incredibly busy strait. And yes, you're concerned about the military threat going through, but you're also just concerned about navigating safely through that congestion.
Is it a bit like a six-lane highway where four of the six lanes are shut down and traffic's got to squeeze through this one or two lanes?
So it's like a six-lane highway but on steroids because ships don't go that fast, which means you can't make last-minute judgment calls and pull out. You've really got to judge how you're going to navigate through that to try and overtake slower vessels, give them the appropriate space to ensure they remain safe, etc.
Why is Iran's position in the Strait so very powerful?
Iran has a geographical blessing in terms of its northern position across the Strait of Hormuz, and in fact across the Persian Gulf more broadly, allows it to geographically control that area. When I deployed there in 2020, my role there was to try and work out how you defended shipping in that Strait of Hormuz short of conflict. And it was a really difficult challenge to work out where you would put your ships to be able to get them in the right position to stop the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps from seizing ships, which is what they had been doing in 2019 and 2020. And you worked out very quickly that Iran's proximity to the strait, some of the elements of the strait actually go through Iran's territorial waters, so 12 nautical miles from the coast, was so much so that you would really struggle going at maximum speed to position your warship to be able to do that. So Iran's geography allows it to dominate that critical waterway and therefore 20% of the world's oil flow.
We've kind of been here before many decades ago. This is going back to the 1980s now during that long and dreadful and harrowing war that no one in the West really remembers anymore, the Iran-Iraq War when Saddam Hussein attacked Ayatollah Khomeini's Iran. It went on for nearly a decade, I think, and I think millions of people died in it. It was an awful thing. One part of this war was something called the Tanker Wars. Can you just explain what happened in this period in the 1980s when the Tanker Wars broke out in the Gulf?
Yeah, look, absolutely. So I guess just stepping back to war in general, a war often becomes about economic attrition. And that's what we're seeing today. And that's what we saw in the tanker wars in the 1980s. So by about 1984, Iran and Iraq had started attacking tankers, or oil tankers, in the strait, so that economic warfare. Now, this wasn't just tankers belonging to each other's countries. This was tankers belonging to multiple countries, including Gulf states like Kuwait, who are entirely dependent on their ability to export oil to support their economy. So this starts to happen in about 84. It starts to intensify in 87. The US and other countries, but the US starts to become heavily involved in this, trying to ensure oil flow out of the Persian Gulf. And so in about 1987, the US starts reflagging Kuwaiti tankers to become US tankers and protecting those tankers through convoy and escort operations, so having warships around you taking you out through the strait. Now, that became quite a tense period, and that put Iran and the US up against each other in a number of military engagements.
Were any US warships hit by enemy fire during these wars?
Yeah, so actually the most kind of significant that people think about is actually the USS Stark. So the USS Stark was a US destroyer. It was hit in May 1987 by an Iraqi Exocet. Now, Iraq said that they had mistaken the US warship for something else. 37 US sailors lost their lives, which was a significant shock to the US Navy. The second one there is the USS Samuel B. Roberts. There's been a lot of conversation the last week about mining in the Persian Gulf and around the Strait of Hormuz. And in fact, during the tanker wars, Iran did deploy floating mines. So they float with the current, and one of these mines actually hit the USS Samuel B. Roberts in the Central Arabian Gulf in April 1988. Now, unlike the USS Stark incident, there was no loss of life there. There were injuries, but it did nearly sink the ship. And the US responded to that with an operation called Operation Praying Mantis, where they sunk a number of Iranian vessels and attacked a number of Iranian oil platforms. And this is why you saw the US conducting those escort and convoy operations through the Central Arabian Gulf up to Kuwait, was because of the concern on the global economy and the US economy if they couldn't get oil out of the Persian Gulf.
Jen, you're a former naval officer who grew up in Broken Hill. That's a long way from the water, Jen. How did you end up in the Navy?
I did, and shout out to anyone who is listening from Broken Hill. I would say, though, it's a long way from salt water. If you want river water, then you've got Menindee Lakes near there, which every now and then makes the news. How did I end up joining the Navy? You know, I often get asked this question. I feel like I should have some inspirational story about an epiphany in the middle of the night or some wonderful poem that I read. But, you know, I think for people who grow up in regional Australia, a lot of these decisions just become practical decisions. Not a lot of options in regional Australia, especially if you want to go to university. And so at the time, you know, the Defence Force Recruiting came around and said, hey, if you guys want to join the military, you can do two things. You can abseil off Sydney Harbour Bridge, which I was like, that looks really cool, and got to do that. That was great. But also we'll pay for you to go to university. And for someone from rural Australia whose family had not been to university, this seemed like a great opportunity. So I rocked up at recruiting and they said to me, do you want to be a seaman officer, a naval warfare officer? And I said, I don't even know what that means, but this sounds great. Over two decades later, it worked out.
What career path did you take through the Navy? What did you specialise in?
Yeah, so I became a naval warfare officer. So initially the journey for that is you join, you go through the Naval College down at Jarvis Bay. I went to sea for 6 months undertaking what was then Relic, now Op Resolute, border patrol operations. Then I went to the Defence Force Academy. Then after that, I completed my warfare training, qualifying in first driving ships, and that's what I was doing in Arunta in the Middle East in 2007, 2008. And then I specialised as a warfare officer, so the person who works in the operations room, the combat centre of the ship, responsible for the employment of the defensive and offensive weapons, so missiles and torpedoes. After that, I was lucky enough to undertake an exchange with the Royal Navy for 3 years, where I specialised in anti-submarine warfare, so hunting submarines, not being on submarines. I like showers, so hunting submarines, and spent a lot of time with the Royal Navy, deployed to the Caribbean, chasing Colombian drug smugglers and drug smuggling boats and submarines. So that was kind of my history and my background in terms of qualifications.
My word, that sounds very 19th century, going after pirates in the Caribbean, literally with the Royal Navy. When you said you were a driver of ships, is that like, you know, in the 19th century, I'm imagining you standing there with that great big wheel directing the ship like a pilot. Is that what you do now? Is that what you ended up doing as a driver, or do you stand there and issue commands?
So you stand there and issue orders. So you're not technically on the what you would call the helm, the steering wheel of a ship. I do have my helmsman certificate. When I went through the Naval College, after that you had to do 6 months at sea before you could go to the military academy. I actually turned 18 at sea, by the way. It was the driest 18th birthday for anyone from Broken Hill that you've ever heard of. But I did have to learn how to drive the helm. But no, when I talk about driving the ship or an officer of the watch, it is issuing orders.
After your first deployment to the Gulf in 2007-2008, you went back again during Donald Trump's first term in office. Tell me what was going on in the Gulf at the time that meant you had to go there.
Yeah, so I actually went there January 2020, just after, in fact, 7 days after Soleimani had been assassinated. So General Soleimani was the head of the Quds Force, which is the special forces in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Trump had made the decision to take him out because of his support to proxies across the region, so the Houthis and Hamas and Hezbollah, etc. So at that time, you know, if we go back in 2018, under the first Trump administration, the US had withdrawn from the JCPOA. Now, I can't remember exactly what that stands for, but effectively the JCPOA was the agreement between the US, European nations and Iran about limiting Iran's nuclear ambitions. It allowed them a certain degree of uranium enrichment. It was agreed under the Obama administration, but the US's position was that Iran was not sticking to those agreements. So once the US pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, Donald Trump, during his first term, put what was called a maximum pressure campaign on Iran, which involved both military pressure and sanctions to get Iran to agree to give up their nuclear weapon ambitions and their uranium enrichment beyond the levels of civil uranium enrichment. So in response to this, and, you know, this is something that Iran has always historically done because of their geographic position, Iran started attacking ships in the Gulf of Oman. So a number of ships in mid-2019 were limpet mined off the port of Fujairah. And they seized some ships in the Strait of Hormuz and generally harassed merchant shipping. What was their aim there? Their aim was to reduce the confidence of the global shipping community to operate through that strait and have an economic impact on the global community and the US in response to the US's sanctions on Iran.
Now, you say they were sticking limpet mines on ships. How are they doing that with scuba divers? How are they sticking these limpet mines on ships?
All of them, it's not quite clear, but certainly there is one example where it was actually a boat from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. You can actually find a video that the US released of one of the limpet mines on the side of a ship where the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps realised that it had malfunctioned. They didn't want this to be attributed to Iran, so they actually went back to try and retrieve the limpet mine, and the US filmed them and put it on the internet. So when you think about these huge anchorages both inside the Gulf and outside of the Gulf, you know, you have hundreds of ships sitting there at anchor, small boats everywhere, fishing boats everywhere. They're really congested. You'd think it'd be obvious if there's a small boat coming up and putting a mine on the side of the ship, but that's not actually necessarily the case. And so they were able to, I think it was six by memory, attack six ships with limpet mines, except the one that failed that they had to retrieve. And also, you can't necessarily trust that those smaller boats are safe for you at all. In fact, going back a bit before my first deployment there, but USS Cole, I think I mentioned earlier, was a US destroyer that had just come into, or just outside of the Port of Aden in Yemen. And it was actually attacked by a suicide boat, a small, nondescript boat that they thought was coming alongside to retrieve their garbage, you know, a little kind of wooden skiff kind of boat, actually had explosives packed into it, went next to the side of the ship and blew itself up. And in fact, I think I mentioned before that, you know, 3 years before my first deployment in 2007, there had been an incident in the Northern Arabian Gulf around the oil platforms there where a wooden dhows, kind of a traditional fishing vessel in the Arabian Gulf, had been packed with explosives and driven out the oil platforms and exploded near a US boarding team, killing a number of them. So, yes, lots of different types of boats, and hard to assess whether that's just a friendly fisherman or something packed with explosives.
So your final deployment was in 2023 to the Gulf as Director of Operations for a combined maritime force. How big a force was this? How many nations were working together in this deployed force?
In 2022-23, I went back for the Combined Maritime Forces. Now, that's an organisation that had existed since the early 2000s. It initially stood up to deal with maritime terrorism in the Middle East, but it expanded over the decades to deal with counter-piracy, counter-narcotics, smuggling, etc. And when I was there, it was 38 different nations, including the Philippines, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, the UK. So quite a, what the term they use over there is a rainbow of navies.
A lot of those nations you mentioned there are quite conservative cultures. Were they cool with having a woman as a commanding officer?
Well, look, I think for some of those countries it was the first time. So Australia, the position I held, Director Ops Combined Maritime Forces, Australia's held that for about two decades. But I was the first female to ever undertake that role, which sounds strange in 22, 23, but that's how it rolled out. Look, I think some of them were originally surprised, and a lot of my direct staff came from countries where they didn't really have women in the military, certainly not in leadership positions or operational leadership positions. So I think initially it was probably a bit of a shock to people from some of those countries. But I think it's one of those things that you learn about human nature, you know, that people might have their views, their different cultural backgrounds, but when they come together, they do respect kind of professional competence. And I developed some fantastic relationships with people I didn't think that I would develop strong relationships with. So it is remarkable how working in that professional military setting can develop those bonds and friendships, no matter where you come from in the world.
So that brings us now to the current conflict in the Persian Gulf and in Iran. I have to admit, I was surprised when the US went in with Israel on this attack. I just assumed, given the dangers that would apparently exist for the United States and the world's oil supply, that President Trump was bluffing and was trying to intimidate Iran to get them to come forward with a leader more compliant with the United States. Were you surprised to see the US join in on the military attack on Iran?
No, I wasn't surprised. And I actually don't, you know, I know there's a narrative out there that Israel pulled the US into that. I actually don't think that's the case. But let me talk through why I think that. The US has always been concerned about Iran, particularly Iran's nuclear weapons program, or if not program, their latent capability to try and develop a nuclear weapon if they chose to do so. They've become increasingly concerned about Iran's ballistic missile capability. Iran's indigenous ballistic missile capability is the most significant in the Middle East, and even if you look worldwide, it would compare to many kind of first-rate militaries. I wouldn't call the Iranian military or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a first-rate military, but their ballistic missile program is incredibly impressive. But I think the US had decided that it was unacceptable for Iran to ever have a nuclear weapons capability. Now, I'm not suggesting that they were a day or weeks away from that. There's certainly no evidence in the public domain that they were that close. But they were enriching uranium to a level well beyond required for civil authorities. They were burying their capabilities underground, and they had developed an increasingly capable ballistic missile capability as well, which would allow them to protect themselves against strikes if they decided to go down that nuclear weapons path. So for the US, that was never, ever going to be acceptable. And to be fair, for Australia's security, Iran going down that path should never be acceptable. Iran is a destabilising force both in the Middle East and globally. And we know that from, you know, Mike Burgess's comments, so Director General ASIO last year, that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps had actually sponsored attacks in Australia in 2024. So I think the US had decided that that was not going to be feasible. Now, how you stop Iran from going down that path, of course, you have two avenues. One is the diplomatic path. The other is the military path. Certainly, I don't think that the current Iranian regime was ever about to give up the latent nuclear weapons capability or the ability to potentially go down that path. And so if that was not going to be solved diplomatically, and of course, you know, in the lead up to this current conflict, we saw the 12-day war last year in June, we saw the US intervene and strike Iranian nuclear facilities, we saw significant rounds of negotiation. And so at some point, if it couldn't be solved diplomatically, the US was always going to, in my view, militarily intervene to stop Iran going down that path. Now, I think that you're always dangerous to draw analogies between different parts of history, but I think that Australians should think about, when we think about the prospect of Iran having potential nuclear weapons, we should think about the fact that in our region, North Korea does have nuclear weapons, North Korea equally a rogue state. We don't talk about this a lot, but through the 90s and the early 2000s, when it became clear that North Korea was going down that path, nobody intervened and nobody did anything about that. And I think if we reflect back now, we would say that that is not a good thing to have a nuclear-armed North Korea. So I think those were the things that were driving the US's thinking. Now, why now is, I think, the big question. I think that potentially the US assessed that the Iranian regime was much weaker after the disablement of a lot of their proxies since October 7, 2023. Israel has been attacking Hezbollah, the Houthis to a point, and Hamas, which has been part of Iran's strategy to control the region. I think there was an assessment that the IRGC, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, had been weakened during the 12-day war in June last year. I think there was an assessment that the regime was weaker itself. And if we look back to late December, and we'll remember the protests on the streets, where the estimates are between 20,000 and 40,000 Iranians were effectively massacred on the streets by Iranian security forces. So I think there was an assessment that the regime was weaker than it had been. I think another pressure into the US thinking here is Iran's asymmetric capabilities, their missile program, which is impressive, their uncrewed aerial vehicle program, which is so impressive that they have been exporting them around the world. You know, if you look at the Russian attacks on Ukrainian energy infrastructure that occurs every winter, a large proportion of those attacks are actually based on the Shahid drones that Iran has exported to Russia. So I think there was a view that Iran's capability was becoming as such that military intervention in future years would be a lot harder because of their ability to defend themselves. So I would suspect that all of those things went into the thinking around timing. Clearly, in terms of the exact timing on the 28th of February, given that one of the first strikes was a political target, taking out the leadership, the Ayatollah, etc., I suspect that exact timing was simply based on intelligence and a target of opportunity. But I think all of those things go into the why now and why military force.
Iran began attacking commercial ships around the Strait of Hormuz in early March. How have these attacks been conducted? What kind of weaponry are they using to attack these commercial tankers, Jenna?
So about 20, 21 ships have been attacked, not just in the Strait of Hormuz, but attacking them across the Gulf and into the Gulf of Oman. They have managed to do this with a range of capabilities, predominantly uncrewed aerial vehicles, which they are a world leader in terms of attack, uncrewed aerial vehicles, and interestingly, uncrewed surface vessels. So think of uncrewed surface vessels really as remotely controlled explosive boats. Now, in 3.5 weeks, 20 attacks or 21 attacks on shipping is nothing compared to the constant bombardment of the Gulf states. But the difference here is it's had a catastrophic impact on the confidence of international shipping to transit through that strait. So they've effectively deterred international shipping from going through that strait, and that's where we sit. The strait itself is not actually closed. We hear that talked about a lot. There's no naval blockade of that strait. There are still some ships going through. There are Iranian ships coming out of the strait carrying oil predominantly to China, and there are some other ships going through. Not a lot. As I said, normally you'd see 130 ships going through that strait every day, 20 to 30 oil tankers. You know, now we're talking maybe 4 or 5.
Iran is launching explosive boats and drones from land emplacements within its own territory. How hard would it be for the United States to take that out with an airstrike? Would they consider doing that in order to allow a much easier form of passage through the Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah, very much so. And that is what they have started doing. And this is interesting, right? It's been a huge debate in the last week and a bit about naval escorts to open up the Strait of Hormuz. But naval escorts is not the way to open the Strait of Hormuz. The way to open the Strait of Hormuz is to reduce Iran's ability to target merchant vessels. And you do that by hitting their command and control. You do that by hitting their radar and detection capabilities, and you do that by taking out their weaponry. So in the last 24 hours, Central Command, are the US co-combatant in charge of this campaign in the Middle East, they have put out that they have been attacking Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps facilities along the coast that house cruise missiles. Now, one of the challenges here, because you just think, oh, well, why don't they just attack that first? There's a couple of challenges. One, Iran has become very capable at burying their weapons underground. So you can find, if you want to look it up online, photos of tunnels and caves where they have hidden hundreds of uncrewed surface vessels, missiles and UAVs. Two, you know, the US has a lot of military power, but they still have limits on what they can achieve. And so it takes them away from achieving other objectives. So they've had to weigh up their apportionment of assets. And I suspect, they haven't stated this, but I suspect the initial focus of the strikes, apart from, of course, the political objectives, taking out some of the leadership that occurred in the first 24 hours, was about ensuring that Iran had no air defence capability. So that would have been target number one, take out any of their ability to detect and engage Israeli and US aircraft across Iran. Once Israel and the US had air control, then I suspect they switched their targets to taking out the ballistic missile silos that Iran has been using to target the Gulf states and the factories and the industrial complex that build those ballistic missiles, and then switching to UAV, uncrewed aerial vehicle stocks, industrial complex that supports them, although that's much harder because it's much easier to build a Shahid drone than it is a ballistic missile, and then moving to targets along the coast. And so I think that the CENTCOM now is focused on taking out those targets along the coast. It's hard to work out how much weaponry Iran has left to undertake these operations. Certainly they had, you know, thousands of UAVs and USVs, uncrewed aerial vehicles and uncrewed surface vessels. Their attacks on shipping have been episodic. It's not like they're attacking shipping every day in significant waves. In fact, between the 11th of March and the 16th of March, there were no attacks on shipping. So it's hard to judge whether that's a strategy by Iran or whether that's a reduction in weaponry because of the US strikes.
Early on in this conflict, US submarines sank an Iranian warship that was in the Indian Ocean. Why was this a move that surprised you, Jen?
Look, it surprised me in terms of the willingness to expand the geography of this conflict. Now, there is nothing in the law of armed conflict that says you can't do that.
When we say the Indian Ocean, what part of the Indian Ocean are we talking about?
Yeah, so 40 nautical miles south of Sri Lanka, so not too far from Australia. And Sri Lanka, of course, sits upon the major maritime trade route that goes from both the Middle East and, in fact, from Europe, because most trade coming to Asia from Europe goes through the Suez Canal, through the Red Sea, through the Bab-el-Mandeb Strait, across the Indian Ocean.
And that trade route's been there for thousands of years too.
For thousands of years, yeah. through the Malacca Strait and into Asia. And this is why, if we go back to World War II, Sri Lanka was a critical geographic position in the Indian Ocean.
So what's the significance of that attack then?
Yes, look, I think the significance is the willingness to use submarines to take out a warship on a key trade route that China is reliant on. And so I think it was about the military aim of destroying Iran's navy, which is one of the stated objectives of the US. But I also personally think it was about sending a message to China about the US's willingness to use force. Now, when you think about the concept of deterrence, so the US's stated strategy with China is deterrence, so deterring them from using force in the Indo-Pacific. Deterrence is something that is kind of psychological. It occurs in your adversary's mind. It's not what you think, it's what your adversary thinks. There's kind of three pillars of it: capability, credibility, and communications. Your adversary needs to think you have the capability to stop them. Your adversary needs to know that you are communicating when you will stop them and that you have the credibility so that you are likely to follow through. So if you have the biggest military in the world, if your adversary doesn't think you would use it against them, then it's not going to deter them. So I think that when you look at that strike, yes, it was part of the Iran conflict, but I think the location of it was also about messaging to China the US's willingness to use force when they see it's in their national interests. And I think you can wrap the intervention of Venezuela up into that conversation as well. And I think that people forget that whether the US intervention in Iran is legal or illegal, and there's cases to be made either way, the law of naval warfare and international humanitarian law and applies no matter what, whether the actual intervention is legal or illegal. And that was an armed warship, which is a lawful target. Now, obviously, horrific to see the loss of those sailors. But I think there's been a lot of kind of misreporting and misunderstanding about that in Australia.
So, Jennifer, if you believe that this US submarine attack on an Iranian ship off the coast of Sri Lanka was partly for the benefit of a Chinese audience, are there other aspects of this war in the Gulf that you think are about China?
So I do, and I think people always want to find the reason for something, and things are generally complex, and there are multiple threads at play, I think, in any political or military decision-making. I think some of the willingness of the current Trump administration to use military force to achieve their foreign policy objectives is about demonstrating that credibility towards China. I think you can wrap Venezuela up in this. I think you can wrap Operation Midnight Hammer, which is the US attacks on Iran in June last year, and this. Now, I don't think that it's just about China. That would be a naive way of looking at it. But I think it is about showing that they are willing to use force. It is also about destroying Iran's capability to support its partners with its military might. And, you know, go back to that example of how significant Iran has actually been to Russia's intervention in Ukraine. Yes, Russia has a range of capabilities, but what has allowed them to continue attacking Ukrainian energy infrastructure is Iranian drones. So I think that all of that wraps up into this. And so I think that the US decision on Iran is also partially about messages to China. I think it's also partially, and now this may or may not be successful, about reducing the amount of geopolitical problems the US has. The US has too many problems and too many adversaries. And so you've seen a push to get Russian and Chinese influence out of South America. We saw the Trump administration, when they came in January 2025, the focus on Panama and then the focus on Venezuela. You know, a lot of people say, oh, Venezuela is about historical grievances and oil. I'm sure all of that plays into it, but it's also about Russian and Chinese influence in South America. In fact, 12 months prior to the seizure of Maduro, we saw Venezuela sign a strategic agreement with Russia. And so I think it is not just about these isolated events. It is also about reducing the amount of problems the US has so we can better focus on China. Now, there are plenty who disagree with that assessment, but I think that is a factor.
If I'm someone in the Iranian leadership, and I don't know how good I am at trying to think like they do, there's another kind of a logic that seems to be at work here, which is that given how safe North Korea apparently seems to be because it possesses nuclear weapons, that so long as there's any power to my regime in Iran, I'm going to pursue a nuclear weapon now, no matter the cost, because in the long run, that's the only thing that's going to keep the outside forces at bay from the regime. So does this mean what we're talking about here is the US is going to be committed to something much more like the Iraq war, where they have to have a totalizing attack, where they have to put boots on the ground, go in, uproot the entire regime, put a more compliant one in place, and shut down by force the program to build a nuclear weapon in Iran? But what I'm saying is, if the US is going to achieve the kind of things you're talking about, going to need to lead to a much wider and long-running war.
So I don't think that that's inevitable at all. I mean, look, how this war ends, you're a fool if you try and predict how a war is conducted and how it ends. But I suspect it ends in diplomacy. It ends in an agreement from whoever is left in the Iranian regime. I don't suspect in the short term, and, you know, I'm not an expert in Iranian politics, but certainly plenty of experts in Iranian politics over the last 3 weeks have said that any regime change is not something that happens overnight. It's something that would take a long period of time. So whoever ends up in power, and I think Israel will keep striking senior leaders within the Iranian regime until someone ends up in power who's willing to make a deal on the nuclear capabilities of Iran, I think that's where this goes to. I think the US would be highly reluctant to put boots on the ground. One, very unpopular in the United States. Two, the US really does need to be focused on China, China's militarization of the Indo-Pacific, so they don't have the bandwidth to get distracted or bogged down in a major conflict. Three, you know, there was a lot of talk in the first 24 hours of this war that the US political objective here was regime change. It's understandable that that was the view, because I think that President Trump kind of misspoke in the first 24 hours of this war. I think by midweek of the first week, we saw an interview where President Trump actually read a teleprompter, which is quite uncommon. He stuck to the teleprompter and he outlined four military objectives for this conflict: destruction of ballistic missile capability, nuclear capability, the Navy, and the proxies. I think the US will walk away if they feel like they have achieved a fair amount of those objectives. So for all of those reasons, I don't think that this is an Iraq or an Afghanistan. I don't think there is any nation building in place here. There's no aspiration to turn Iran into a liberal democracy, which I think is positive. I think that getting bogged down in the Middle East would be detrimental to Australia's security in the Indo-Pacific. So I don't think it's inevitable that there are ground troops. I think that that is unlikely. If there was mission creep, I think that would be catastrophic for the US in terms of their competition with China in the Indo-Pacific.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but I still don't see what the incentive is for the regime to abandon its nuclear program. I don't see, no matter what agreement they arrive at with the United States, it's going to make that leadership not want to continue to pursue a nuclear weapon in secret, no matter how much they might be nodding at whatever the United States is asking of them.
Yeah, look, that's a fair point, right? Many people have made that argument. I would say that there's a significant economic incentive for them to do so. Iran has suffered significantly under the economic sanctions. In fact, that's what led to a number of the significant protests internally. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is not like your normal military. They are very much involved in industry and in economics and making money out of their role in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. So I think that there is an economic argument too, that at some point it is worth making concessions on that. Protests on the street and uprisings are not good for the regime either. And a lot of that is driven by not just the persecution within Iran, but driven by the economic situation that your everyday Iranians are experiencing. So I think there is an economic incentive for Iran to trade away its nuclear program. I just think that economic case needs to be made to Iran. And unfortunately, that is by reducing their ability to, one, get oil out and, two, produce it.
The United States has plenty of enemies, as you say. And increasingly, it seems to be losing its friends or regarding its friends with disdain. One of the most puzzling things about this is President Trump insisting or expressing his disappointment that despite not having advised his allies about the fact he was going to Iran, that they haven't come in to help, that NATO hasn't come in to help, that Australia and Japan haven't come in to help. And now he's saying, well, we don't need you anyway. Is this any way to run a war, Jennifer?
No, look, this kind of development during the week, first of President Trump calling for countries to send navies to help open up the Strait of Hormuz. And as I said earlier, you know, you don't open up that strait through naval power. It's actually through air power and land power, taking out Iran's ability to target it on land first. And then it's a naval reassurance mission. Look, I don't think that call for ships was about operations. I think it was about two things. I think, one, it was about wanting political support, wanting more political support from the US's allies and partners. Two, I think it was about reassuring markets. Now, I'm not an expert in oil costs in any way, shape or form. But when you think about the oil market, most people think that it's just based on supply and demand. Therefore, supply is constricted because of the Strait of Hormuz, and that's why prices is going up. It is a little bit more complex than that. In the near term, the oil market is actually based on speculation. So what people think will happen in the oil market, not actually purely on supply and demand. And so I think he was trying to reassure markets that the US had a plan to get oil flowing back through the Strait of Hormuz. And so therefore the statements around creating a coalition to do that were aimed at that reassurance rather than actually having ships escorting through the Strait of Hormuz. The actual operational aspects of escorting or convoying ships through the Strait of Hormuz would be too much of a risk right now, I would suggest. So I think it was about that. I think the response 24 hours later, when you know he had limited uptake from allies and partners, you know, not to use the term tantrum, something short of that, but it seemed kind of related to that. You know, Australia was mentioned in his Truth Social point as not supporting. But, you know, our government has said that we were not asked to send a ship. We have sent an aircraft over there, an airborne early warning aircraft to help protect UAE. So, look, I think that it is counterproductive, absolutely. Clearly, there are messages, very obvious messages, from the Trump administration since he came into power over 12 months ago that they want allies to do more and lift their end of the bargain kind of thing. And I think that that is not an unreasonable expectation. Now, I don't agree with the way that they have articulated that. But I think it is true to say that allies and partners of the US have become too reliant on US military capability to act as a deterrent and underinvested in their own military capability. And I think that's a fair assessment of Australia. You know, after the end of the Cold War, Australia underinvested in its military capability and now has limited ability to defend its vital interests, which does make it a liability to major allies like the US. And you can say the same about the UK. I mean, you know, despite the amazing women and men in the UK Armed Forces and the Royal Navy, the fact is that the Royal Navy struggles to get ships to sea right now. So therefore, as an island nation like the Royal Navy, it is difficult to defend itself. So I think that that messaging from the Trump administration is probably on point. I think that the language that they have used and the Truth Social points do undermine relationships. So I think that that does set back this military campaign a little bit.
Now, we've talked about potential US objectives in this conflict, but Israel's its partner in this war. Israel, we know, has just destroyed an Iranian oil field and assassinated a fair swathe of Iran's leadership. The countries seem to have different and at times conflicting objectives here. President Trump seems surprised that a couple of people they had in mind to negotiate an end to the war with were now dead. Do you see this as the case, that there are conflicting objectives here between the United States and Israel in this war?
I think it is potentially the case. I think you know, with no disrespect to the US administration, I think you can't react to everything that, well, I think we should have all learned that you can't react to everything that President Trump says. He says things for different reasons, whether he means them or not. You know, for example, the US administration being surprised that Iran attacked merchant shipping. Nobody in the US military is surprised that Iran attacked merchant shipping. So I think you've got to be careful not to read too much into what he says. And of course, what he says changes day to day. But I think it is clear from the attacks that occurred that Israel is going after more of Iran's economic capabilities, their oil production, their gas production. That's not consistent with the four stated military objectives of the US that I've talked about previously. That is more consistent with applying significant pressure on the regime, and the assassinations are very much about taking out the key leadership in the regime. Now, why Israel is doing that, look, we haven't heard from the Israeli government a clear statement on that. You can make the argument that that is inconsistent with the stated US military objectives and could prolong this conflict. Now, it's very clear that the US don't want to get bogged down in Iran. So in the first week, we saw the US say 4 to 5 weeks, or 4 to 6 weeks is how long they assessed this war was going to go on for. And I think that that's probably a reasonable time frame. Clearly, the US are concerned about markets and global economic impacts. So these Israel strikes without further explanation do seem to be at odds with that. And so potentially they do have different objectives, which could prolong and bog down this war. I think the other concern here is that the US pull out without achieving their objectives. The danger of the US pulling out without achieving their four military objectives is that we may well end up here again in 12 months or in 2 years with, yes, a setback Iran in terms of military capability, but a much more experienced Iran in terms of defending themselves against the US, and that would be a bad situation to be in.
In the light of what you've just told me, that sounds like the more likely outcome here. America's already given a time frame for when it wants to leave this war, which will only, I would think, encourage the regime to hold out as long as they can. They just need to hold out and then recommence their pursuit of a nuclear weapon afterwards.
Well, look, I don't think the US's objectives here are regime change. I think that assessment of 4 to 6 weeks was the assessment of how long Central Command thought it would take them to target the ballistic missile facilities, the nuclear facilities, the Navy facilities, etc. So that would be based on an assessment of, okay, what are the amount of targets that they think they need to hit to achieve those military objectives, and how long is that going to take? So I suspect that's what those predictions were based on. If they follow through with that, and again, I don't know what their target set is, but if they follow through with that, then even an Iranian regime in place that is more angry will have a limited ability to rebuild that capability. If they only get halfway through those military objectives and pull out and leave Iran still with a significant ballistic missile program, a nuclear program, then yes, that is a real concern, and that is a more dangerous Iran.
There's been some speculation in the world media that the United States might contemplate sending in a team of commandos into where they believe this fissionable material might be in Iran to retrieve it. Would that be incredibly dangerous to do that? There'd be risk of radiation leaks or maybe even something worse. Is that in any way a feasible scenario in your mind, Jennifer?
I'm not sure it's the most likely scenario. I think and hope that the most likely scenario is actually a diplomatic solution on where that highly enriched uranium goes. But it is a scenario. I mean, if the US is intent on prosecuting its military objective of setting back or destroying Iran's nuclear program, then it must get positive control or at least have a trusted partner with positive control of that highly enriched uranium. And if Iran is not going to hand that over, and there's been all sorts of talk about, you know, would that be handed to a third party to look after? Could that go somewhere else? Then that is going to have to be under someone's positive control. So do I think that is a likely outcome right now? I don't. But is it a possible outcome? Yes, it is. And, you know, the thing is that when conflicts commence, all sorts of things can happen. And in the end, if they do want to achieve that military objective of destroying Iran's nuclear capability and potential, somebody will need to have positive control of that highly enriched uranium.
If you take the 60,000-foot view from all of this, you can look at nations like Australia and other nations and see that we're very heavily energy reliant on extracting oil from politically unstable places and getting them through this pinch point on the Persian Gulf. We know that China, that lacks fossil fuels, is pursuing energy independence not so much as a climate change objective, but as a strategic objective to keep itself safer. Do you think other nations are likely now to learn the same lesson from this and pursue energy independence after this event?
I think that nations will be looking at this event, but not only this event, you know, looking at the impacts on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, looking at Venezuela, and thinking that enhancement of their own resilience, whether that is energy resilience or resilience in other areas, is important. And that is something that, you know, Australia should be focusing on right now. I do think that there are still economic imperatives at play, which makes me think that once this is over, you'll still see a key focus on energy supplies from the Middle East, because that is more economically viable in many ways. But yes, I do think you'll see countries looking much more at their own resilience and, you know, what is their susceptibility to this kind of vulnerability of just-in-time delivery, and whether that is of fuel, whether that is of pharmaceutical, whether that is of key inputs into their food security, like fertilisers. And that's, I think, you know, that's something I think Australia should be thinking about, you know. When you are highly vulnerable to shocks to the maritime domain, you need to look at how you reduce that vulnerability. Now, most people go, well, the answer to that is more warships to defend against that, which for Australia's case, we do need more warships. But actually, the first step is thinking about, well, how do you reduce that vulnerability through your industrial policy, through stockpiling, through the internal decisions you make? And then you start to think about, okay, once I've reduced that vulnerability, how do I defend it? And so I think a lot of countries will be having that conversation right now. But I don't think it's just because of the Strait of Hormuz. You know, the maritime domain across the world has become increasingly contested. Shadow fleet tankers, harassments in the South China Sea, harassments around the Red Sea. I mean, you know, going back to November 23, the Houthis started attacking shipping across the Red Sea to the point where most shipping coming from Europe to Asia had to divert 2 weeks around the Cape of Good Hope. So I think this increasingly contested maritime domain will force countries to think about their own resilience.
Fascinating speaking with you, Jennifer, and really great to get your insights. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Jennifer Parker is with the ANU's National Security College, and she's also a fellow at the Lowy Institute. Today's conversation with Jennifer Parker was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Jennifer Leake, and executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.